From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Longtime Donald Trump associate Roger Stone was arraigned today in Washington, D.C., pleading not guilty to charges that included lying and concealing efforts to contact WikiLeaks, flashing his Nixonian homage, both hands up in the V for victory sign, as he left the court. Stone is just one of many former Trump campaign aides that have been indicted by special counsel Robert Mueller. But his chapter unfolds as acting Attorney General Matthew Whitaker raised eyebrows when he said the last chapter is coming in the Mueller investigation. What does this all mean? NPR Justice Correspondent Ryan Lucas has been on it. Hi, Ryan.
Hi there.
And you said on Morning Edition you were more interested in what happened outside the court with Roger Stone. We saw the Nixon hand wave. What else did we see? Were there protesters, as there have been?
Well, I wouldn't go so far as saying more interested in what would happen outside the courtroom, but there was certainly a lot of interest in what the scene would look like and whether it would be a repeat of the kind of raucous scene that we saw outside of the courthouse in Florida when Stone made his initial court appearance after his arrest there, when there were protesters and people jeering and booing him. And outside of the courthouse today in D.C., there was a very large crowd of journalists. You had cameramen, photographers, people yelling questions at him. But you also did have members of the public, some of whom were carrying, placards saying "Free Roger Stone, Jail Hillary," going after Robert Mueller. Stone walked into the courtroom, kind of flashed a smile at people, and headed on in. But that's wasn't quite as raucous as the scene in Florida, but certainly a larger gathering than we've seen when other people have been indicted. Showed up in court in the Mueller investigation.
Remind us why he is such a touchstone. He is the president's informal advisor friend, the guy who was tweeting before the election, something's going to happen, I know something. But remind us, what role officially did he play in the Trump campaign, and what's he charged with?
Well, officially, he was only on the campaign until around August of 2015, but he remained an outside advisor of sorts throughout the campaign, up through the election. The indictment alleges that he was also directed by senior campaign officials through the summer of 2016 to try to get in touch with WikiLeaks about those hacked Democratic emails that the U.S. intelligence community, of course, says was hacked by Russia. And Stone was asked to basically suss out what WikiLeaks' plans were for releasing those emails. And then the indictment also says that essentially he took steps to try to keep secret the details of some of those efforts to contact WikiLeaks.
Now the question is whether or not he will continue to plead not guilty, whether he will cooperate with Robert Mueller. But what do you make of, as this is all happening, we hear Acting Attorney General Matthew Whitaker speak about the Mueller investigation yesterday at a press conference. Let's listen.
Right now, the investigation is, close to being completed, and I hope that we can get the report from Director Mueller as soon as possible.
As you well know, some analysts were aghast because you're not supposed to talk or reveal anything. I mean, Robert Mueller hasn't said anything. You're not supposed to reveal anything. What's the sense of, is that true that it's ending, or was he just new in the job? What's the sense of what happened there?
Well, there's been a lot of speculation that the Mueller investigation is kind of drawing to a close, that we're in the final stages of it. Whitaker's comments came at the end of a news conference related to indictment relating to China. He was asked this question, and he prefaced his answer by saying, it's an ongoing investigation, and I'm not going to talk about it. And then he proceeded to talk about it and gave this sort of stumbling answer when he then revealed that it's drawing to a close. It's difficult to read into this too much. This is the first time that we've heard from a senior DOJ official about the timeline for the Mueller investigation. But again, Whitaker may not be there by the time the Mueller investigation draws to a close. Remember, President Trump's nominee to lead the Justice Department as a full-time Attorney General, William Barr, is expected to win confirmation, and that will likely happen within the next couple of weeks.
And that press conference, we should note, was abruptly ended after he blurted that out. Real quick, did we learn anything new when intel chiefs briefed the Senate on security threats today?
Well, we saw the disconnect between the intelligence community and the White House on a number of key issues. We've seen this before. That disconnect continues. That's on things such as the Islamic State. Trump says it's defeated. Intel leaders say that, yes, the Islamic State has been weakened, but still has thousands of fighters in Iraq and Syria. And there's a similar disconnect on North Korea and Iran.
Yeah. NPR Justice Correspondent Ryan Lucas, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, in Congress, bipartisan negotiations begin tomorrow aimed at ending another government shutdown before it starts in 3 weeks. Democrats and Republicans are still far apart on funding President Trump's border wall. The dispute is putting lawmakers in purple districts in a tough spot. Joining us now is freshman Congresswoman Abigail Spanberger, Democrat from Virginia, who back in November won in a district that hasn't elected a Democrat in 50 years. Congresswoman, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you so much for having me.
What would you think if the president in the next couple of weeks decides to declare a national emergency and just build the wall without Congress's approval?
Oh, that's certainly a possibility. It's something he's talked about multiple times. I would think that it is alarming that we have a president who, once again, is willing to show kind of a general disregard for the checks and balances and the co-equal branches of government that we have. And I would also be very eager to ask him exactly what emergency it is that gives him the authority to move forward with that effort.
Well, you're a former CIA officer. Do you think that there's an emergency at the southern border?
I do not. And I think that the fact that we haven't had a quote-unquote emergency for the past 2 years and suddenly we have now found ourselves with an emergency is indication of it. It's more of a political discussion. Do I think that we need to strengthen our border security and the ability of our law enforcement personnel to conduct good interdictions and make sure we don't have drugs coming into this country and to ensure that we know who is coming through our ports of entry? Absolutely. But I wouldn't constitute it as an emergency, particularly when all the data show that apprehensions are down, and overall, if the need is to better know who and what is coming across the border, you know, that's not an emergency. That's an issue of evolving technology and trying to be responsive to dynamic changes that are occurring with how drug traffickers may function and how others may attempt to cross the border.
Do you think that there's a possibility of a big deal in the next couple of weeks, maybe something more comprehensive than people were talking about before? Or do you think at least that the two sides can come together and agree to fund the government and do what needs to be done to make everybody at least somewhat happy on the issue of border security?
Yeah, I think the real challenge is that we've reached a point where we're essentially now in this 3 week turnaround time. And some people feel as though they essentially have a gun to their head in terms of let's not shut down the government again. I think that the common goal is to never experience another government shutdown. They're wasteful. They're inefficient. They're dreadfully harmful to the individuals impacted. They're detrimental to our economy and our border security and our national security overall. But I think where we can see agreement is we will. And I do think that the group of individuals who will be leading these conversations, I think that it will be incumbent upon them to really work to make sure that the suggestions and the proposals that they are making are based on data more than fulfilling or not fulfilling political promises.
You were one of the 15 Democrats who did not vote for Nancy Pelosi for Speaker. Are you glad that she's Speaker now? A lot of people looking at what just happened and saying she won that fight with President Trump.
Yeah, it's true. I did not vote for her. I voted for someone else. And I think that she did a fine job. I think that, you know, I am pleased with the fact that the government is now open. You know, I'm a new member of Congress, and yesterday was my first day on the House floor in an open government, which is really astounding when we think about the fact that we've now been here since the beginning of January. And so I'm pleased that we reached an end to the shutdown, and I hope that we'll find ourselves in a place where people are leading the charge to ensure that it never happens again.
Congressman, I want to ask you one more question. You've just won a seat on the House Foreign Affairs Committee, and we've been covering the news in the last day or so that it appears the U.S. has reached the start of a peace deal with the Taliban in Afghanistan. This is America's longest war. The Taliban was overthrown right after 9/11 by the United States and others. What do you think about that? Do you trust that? Are you okay with the idea of making peace with the Taliban, which, you know, allowed al-Qaeda to form and plan the attacks of 9/11 within Afghanistan?
There's a large broad swath of what it means to make peace. No longer be actively engaged against an entity does not necessarily mean that we are suddenly allies. I don't think it's a mistake. I think that this is a time when we have to depend completely on our intelligence community and our diplomatic community to ensure that we know what it is that we're getting into, who it is that we're dealing with, and to continue to watch the situation in the event that any elements may change along the way, that we can revise our strategy and determine if it, in fact, we're making the best choice for American national security priorities.
So at the moment, it sounds like you're saying maybe good news.
In issues of national security like this, I think that I'm a little bit more hesitant to ever declare. You'll never hear me declare victory or that we have reached a set forth goal. But I think that we are perhaps moving in the right direction. And so I am cautiously optimistic that continuing in that direction is the beneficial path.
That is Democratic Congresswoman Abigail Spanberger of Virginia. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
One thing all of us humans have in common is that at a certain point in our childhood, we go through puberty. We get bigger, our bodies change, we often get a little rambunctious and moody, and we mature sexually. Well, imagine if that happened not when you were 11 or 13 or 15, but when you were a toddler. That's the experience of our next guest, Patrick Burley, who has a rare genetic mutation that triggers testosterone production in boys as young as 2 years old. Doctors call it precocious puberty. Patrick Burley is now 39. He wrote about his experience in New York Magazine, and he joins us now from NPR West in Culver City, California. Patrick, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Well, first, just tell us about this, because I bet a lot of people haven't heard of this precocious puberty or testotoxicosis.
Yeah. So this particular kind of precocious puberty is called male familial limited precocious puberty, and it's extremely rare. It's estimated that there might be like fewer than 1,000 mm-hmm. of us. And basically, it's a mutation of the luteinizing hormone choriogonadotropin receptor gene, which is responsible for triggering testosterone production in the testicles.
And when did you or when did your parents first realize that you had it?
Well, my father had it, and my grandfather and my great-grandfather. So they were anticipating it, and they started to see symptoms of puberty when I was about 2 years old.
What do you mean symptoms so, at that age?
Pubic hair, uh-huh. essentially. Pubic hair. I was bigger, considerably bigger than a two-year-old. And also impulsive behavior that's characteristic of someone going through puberty.
Like
just, you know, an inability to control my impulses, you know, aggressive outbursts, hitting other kids, tantrums that were kind of truly epic, just behavior that was extreme.
And in terms of your size, I mean, there's a picture that you show in New York Magazine where you're with a sports team as a kid and you're like twice the size of all the other kids on the team.
Yeah, I was huge. I mean, I was the first time I went to I was treated for the mutation at the National Institutes of Health in Maryland. And my first visit, I was about 3 years old, and I weighed as much and was as tall as a seven-year-old and had the testosterone levels of a 14-year-old, mm-hmm. kind of deep in the throes of puberty. So I was huge, and I was not just bigger, but also, you know, I had all this testosterone coursing through my body, so I was muscular. And, you know, when I was 3 and 4 years old, I was kind of basically until I was about seven, sort of an athletic phenom. I was hitting home runs, and I was like, everyone wanted me on their team because I was just much bigger and stronger.
How aware were you of what was going on?
I knew I was different, obviously, and I knew that, you know, I was taking a lot of medication to suppress the production of testosterone. So I knew that, you know, there was something sort of wrong with me biologically. But beyond that, I didn't know much. And I also, you know, I have no memory of a time before all of this, you know. So there was no moment when it kind of changed for me physically, which is normally what happens when you're, you know, a conscious 13-year-old and your body starts to change.
And is that the way that you thought of it? Is that there was something wrong with you?
Yeah. Yes. Because it was so behavioral and because I was, you know, beginning at about 4 and 5, I started to get in trouble in school a lot because I just wasn't able to control my impulses, and I looked so dramatically different from everyone else that, you know, sort of normal misbehavior was amplified in my case. And, you know, if there were a group of us and we were all, you know, doing something wrong on the playground, like I stuck out and would kind of take the blame. And so sort of being bad and looking different and feeling different was all sort of packaged up together.
You also, as you write, started sort of experimenting sexually pretty young.
I did. It was, I started to lie about my age when I was probably about 8. It was easy to do this because I looked so much older, and it was also, in a way, it was easier for me to not have to explain why I looked so much older.
Just pretend that you actually were.
Exactly. Yeah. So I would just tell people that I was, you know, when I was 8, I would tell them I was 12 or 13. And so I started to hang out with older kids and kids who were, you know, doing things that were kind of beyond my peers. And, you know, and that meant sexual stuff, and it also meant smoking cigarettes and experimenting with substances and, you know, kind of all the rebellious behavior that's normally associated with teenagers I started to do when I was considerably younger.
What did your father, who also had the same thing, what did he tell you all along the way? It sounds like he was rather reserved about it, didn't want to talk about it that much.
Yeah, yeah. It had been very difficult for him, not only because of everything that I'm describing now, but also there were just circumstances about his childhood that were especially challenging. And for that reason, he didn't want to investigate that with me, which was, you know, it was a defense mechanism. It was a way for him to survive and cope. And, you know, he grew up in the 50s and the 60s, and I think there's also a sort of a generational mindset that contributes to that. And so, you know, he was very loving and very supportive of me, but, you know, he never sat me down and said, you know, listen, I know what you're going through. I know you're, you know, having sexual feelings at 5. You know, I've been there, and this is kind of how you should navigate it, because this is how I navigated it. Those conversations didn't happen.
Once you turned, what, like 15, everyone else kind of caught up to you?
Yeah, about 14 or 15. Everyone else caught up, and I also finished, you know, and kind of the convergence of those two really, like, it was almost overnight. You know, all of a sudden I kind of looked around and I no longer stuck out. I was no longer, you know, this outcast. And also just hormonally, I was all of a sudden kind of more subdued.
And then that's it. There are no more effects after that. Once you've finished puberty, you're done?
Yeah, basically. I mean, there's the one kind of lingering is that men who have this, they don't grow to their full stature, what they call target height. So like most men who have had familial male limited precocious puberty end up only being around 5 feet tall. Mm-hmm. I ended up being 6 feet tall, and I think that's a combination of the medication that I took and all my treatment, as well as just having tall genes. Like my brother is 6'6", and he didn't inherit the mutation. So I think I was lucky in that way. But other than that, no, there no. It's purely developmental. Once, you know, puberty is done with you, it's done. It goes away.
Was it a relief when it was done? Or how did that feel when you grow up your whole childhood, you're different than everybody else, and then all of a sudden you're the same?
You know, I mean, I still kind of feel different, honestly, even though, you know, if you met me, you wouldn't think of me as different. But I think those feelings of being other and not fitting in, as well as sort of being labeled bad, you know, from an early age, you know, they stayed with me, even though, you know, by the time I was 15 or 16, I had sort of made a 180-degree turn in my life, and I was no longer getting in trouble, and I did well in school, and I was, you know, a decent athlete. So I think that I did, once I began to fit in, I did feel relief, and at the same time, like a desire to, not unlike my father, kind of hide my past and hide the challenges and the what I felt for a long time was kind of a deviant past.
That is Patrick Burley, and that is just part of his story. Tomorrow, we'll hear the rest of our conversation as Patrick discusses the decision he and his wife made about whether or not to screen their embryos for this genetic mutation and to select embryos without it so their son wouldn't go through the same struggles that Patrick, his father, grandfather, and great-grandfather had gone through. By the way, his great-grandfather has an amazing story of his own. He was so big as a 13-year-old that he was able to enlist in the Navy and fight in World War I.
He suffered mustard gas poisoning and was hospitalized. And only then did the U.S. government discover that he was actually only 13 at the time, and they sent him home.
That part of the story tomorrow on Here and Now. And you can read more about Patrick at hereandnow.org.
Here and Now is supported by LegalZoom, who wants you to know that if you want to make 2019 the year you finally start a business or secure your family's future, LegalZoom can help. With their network of independent attorneys licensed in all 50 states, LegalZoom can help you navigate your legal needs, from wills and trusts to LLCs, trademarks, contract reviews, and more. And the best part is, LegalZoom is not a law firm, so they don't charge by the hour. More at LegalZoom.com/now.
Millions of Midwesterners are bracing for extreme cold this week. Tomorrow's high temperature is forecast to be minus 14 degrees in Chicago and Minneapolis. But a story now about a group of military rescue operators who seek out sub-zero temperatures as part of their training. The Air Force's Pararescue Command medics jump out of planes and helicopters to rescue injured service members, often behind enemy lines. And in between deployments, many of them are refining their search and rescue techniques in the vast wilderness and bitter cold of Alaska, as Alaska Public Media's Zachariah Hughes reports.
Hey, good morning. This is Eric from the flight deck here. We are about to take off in the next 5 minutes.
As the exit ramp on the C-130 cargo plane drops open, you can see frosty trees and frozen rivers zooming by down below. This is a training mission for a small group of pararescuers, or PJs, and the flight crew carrying them above Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson near Anchorage. They practice tossing supplies towards drop zone targets. Next out, the humans. Two PJs and their commanding officer step casually into the sub-freezing air like you would into a swimming pool. Eventually, they drift back into view beneath their parachutes for the last leg of the 4,000-foot descent.
So in terms of rescue, this is the place to be.
Major Niall Mansky is an officer in the 212th Rescue Squadron. He and other PJs train to rescue wounded service members from any type of extreme terrain, often while negotiating perilous weather and enemy fire in war zones, which is why, Mansky says, doing rescues in Alaska is such good training.
The missions that we have here in Alaska are as complicated, as difficult, and as life-threatening as they are downrange.
Downrange is military speak for combat zone. Mansky was recently deployed to Iraq and Syria, using many of the same rescue medicine techniques as he employs parachuting from an airplane or dangling off a helicopter to reach injured hikers, stranded snow machiners, or mountainous airplane crashes in Alaska. PJs like Mansky are the specialists of last resort in the state's elaborate web of search and rescue capabilities. In Alaska, they're sent out more than 100 times a year. Knowing when that's what the situation calls for is determined by the Rescue Coordination Center, run out of a modest office on base. There, Lieutenant Colonel Keenan Zirkel is part of a staff of 12 that monitors military and civilian search and rescue emergencies around the clock. His connection with the Rescue Center is personal.
I love it because my brother was pulled off of a mountain by this unit back in 1995 when he was in a plane crash. And this unit went out and saved his life, so it's pretty special for me to get to be part of this and go out and pick up other people that are doing the same thing.
Not every remote medical emergency or search and rescue operation calls for military assets, but the center acts like a brain, a headquarters for centralizing information and figuring out the best thing to do. Because Alaska's so big and the weather's so challenging, Zirkel says the rescue center personnel get a lot of practice that ends up benefiting operations in conflict zones and natural disasters.
We're used to flying in the dark. We're used to flying over mountains. We're used to flying in snowstorms. We're used to being out of gas. We're used to somebody bleeding in the back. We get exposed to these stressors.
By its own count, during the last two decades, the Rescue Coordination Center under the Alaska National Guard has saved around 2,400 lives. For Here and Now, I'm Zachariah Hughes in Anchorage.
A while back, we spoke with a science writer about dry eye, the condition in which your eye doesn't make enough tears or the oily film that keeps them wet, so your eyes can get irritated or you feel like someone has slashed them with a razor. Here's writer Bryn Nelson.
I heard again and again from patients and researchers who knew of people personally who had committed suicide or who had attempted it.
At the time, I remember thinking, can it really be that bad? Well, it can. One day, bam, brought to my knees by, what, a burning cinder? Maybe a shard of glass? Nope, dry eye. And I joined 5 million Americans using dry eye drops and an overnight ointment to ward it off. But recently, the ointment has been disappearing from store shelves, especially Allergan's Refresh Overnight. I found online forums and patient support groups devoted to sightings. A friend called, try the Walmart in Las Vegas. Rebecca Petras is the founder of DryEyeZone.com as well as Dry Eye Talk on Facebook, two of the forums. She's also founded the not all that profitable DryEyeShop.com and the nonprofit Dry Eye Foundation. Rebecca, we should say you are not a doctor, but a patient and an advocate.
Absolutely. I just have a very deep passion for helping people that suffer from the more severe forms of dry eye. Mm-hmm. We're still really not getting the solutions that we need. People are still in a scramble for information and even more for understanding and emotional support.
Okay, you say we, and we're going to ask about how you come to this table. But first, I just want to bring some news to the table. Allergan's Refresh PM, which everywhere I looked, it had a slot on the shelf, but there was never anything there. And you, what, you know, pounded the pavement trying to get Allergan to talk to you about it. How did you actually get into Allergan?
Okay. So one of my pieces of the dry eye world is the Dry Eye Shop. That's this little retail store. We use it more as kind of an information center than anything else. But when I first became aware there were some shortages of Refresh PM, I actually started trying to buy it from them. And that gave me access to the line that doctors get into Allergan to be able to purchase things. I called them basically every week for, I would say, 8 months, trying to get an update on what was going on. And for the first long while, it was just, oh, it's out of stock. It'll probably be back next week. And then it was, oh, it's definitely going to be back by February 21st. And then it was, oh, we actually have some on the way to you. Oh, oops, we don't. Mm. And then it was, we're so sorry, we don't know, but it should be back within a couple of weeks. And each time I seemed to get a different story. Sometimes it was, there's a shortage of a component, which was puzzling because, you know, there's like three ingredients in it and none of them are scarce. And another time it was, actually, it relates to the damage to a facility because of Hurricane Maria back in 2017. That's on the physician line. I kept getting strung along with these different stories. Patients who were calling were getting, you know, even a wider variety of explanations for it. It really wasn't until, I want to say, late spring, beginning of summer, that they finally acknowledged, actually, we do have a longer problem, and they were kind of quietly acknowledging to me that they didn't know when and that it could be as late as 2020.
Well, and 2 weeks ago, you tweeted out a statement that Allergan gave you. You know, as this was going on, you feel crazy enough when you suddenly are struck by lightning, which is what these severe dry eye cases feel like. And you know, people look at you like, what's wrong with you? There's something in your eye. No, you're brought to your knees. But then to constantly see this empty shelf space makes you feel even crazier. And I wondered, is this a thing? Is this a thing? And you tweeted out, by the way, this is a thing, you wrote. And you had a statement from Allergan. So what's the problem?
The information we've been given really is very limited. The only thing I know for sure is that they're having to switch from metal tubes to laminate tubes, and that's what's holding up the whole process. And it's expected to come back maybe at earliest, kind of late summer, they're hoping August, September this year. But why the metal tubes are a problem, I don't know anything about that. Nearly every ointment on the market, either over-the-counter or prescription, is sold in metal tubes. So it's still a big mystery, and the impact has been enormous because Refresh PM ointment has by far the largest market share. So when it started disappearing from stores, the domino effect through the industry, and then all of a sudden we've got Systane is disappearing here and there, and then, you know, Gentile and Sue, the other brands, I imagine it's just the absence of Refresh PM could have created such a run on them, because I know people have been stockpiling any ointment that they can get. For example, last summer we went through about a 2-month stretch where you couldn't get any of them online, not the brand names, not the like the CVS and Walgreens and Walmart generics. They were just gone. And we basically made ourselves a helpline for people who need eye ointment. They're panicking.
Yeah. Well, with good reason. Again, it can be excruciating. Let's talk for a second about dry eye. We know some medications can cause it, dry environments or environments with wind and smoke, some disorders like lupus, prolonged screen time without blinking enough, hello, or in your case, a bad procedure, LASIK surgery?
That's right. Dry eye tends to top the list for the most common side effect from LASIK in a mild form, but there's also a less common severe form. I also had vision complications from the LASIK, and I use these special contact lenses called scleral lenses. They basically act like a prosthetic over the eye, holding fluid over the eye all day long. When I don't have them in, I'm in trouble.
Well, as we said, you are not a doctor, and people should consult with doctors who are familiar with dry eye. Not all eye doctors are. But in the meantime, talk about the emotional, because I know this really concerns you.
The impact is so much more than anyone could imagine. It can affect people at work, so then they become afraid for their work future. Their relationship with their doctor can be very, very challenging because we have this problem in dry eye where what we're experiencing as patients can be light years away from what the doctor's seeing through the slit lamp. I go in and I'm in so much pain, and the doctor's looking at me and saying, well, you know, actually, your corneas look pretty good. Then there's just when you have constant pain and nothing is helping it, it wears people down, a special form of depression. I've basically counseled people over the phone, and it's been my experience that almost everyone I know that has gone through this, they go through a period of depression that may be totally different than anything they've ever experienced before. And that in itself is really, really unnerving. I've heard people, admit that they're having really troubling thoughts and even suicidal ideation. It's just very disturbing. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, in the eye care professions, they don't understand that well. And so they tend to give very simple blanket advice such as, well, don't take those antidepressants because those might dry your eyes out further, which is not necessarily great advice for a dry eye patient because there may come a point where what's going on in their head is actually worse than what's going on in their eyes, and they need to get proper support and help.
Well, and I'll add to that, once it starts, you can't stop it. You have to ride it out. The key is preventing it from happening, which is why those ointments are so important. But in the meantime, you also offer other suggestions. Some make a lot of sense. Have a humidifier. Check for vents that could be blowing right in your eyes. wear moisture chamber glasses. What are they?
Moisture chamber glasses are basically any type of glasses or goggles that will have some kind of shield between the frame and your skin. So it allows moisture to build up in front of your eyes, and it blocks any air movements over your eyes. It's just a tool to get comfortable without any, you know, cost to it.
Yeah. Well, when you can finally move, because in the worst moments, you can't even move. It's just, again, it's like a barbed wire on your eyeball, just quite something.
I would really like to just challenge these manufacturers to step up and communicate, because mm-hmm. their failure to tell us what's going on is hurting patients. Yeah. We field calls every day. Cancer patients, people whose lids don't close, have had damage, have had tumors removed and things, they rely on these ointments. We really need to know what's coming back when and be able to figure out, and especially the doctors be able to know what to recommend for their patients. Because right now we have this effect of doctors telling their patients to go out and buy thus and such an ointment, usually Refresh PM, and it's not there.
That's Rebecca Petras, founder of DryEyeZone.com, as well as the Dry Eye Talk Facebook forum. She's founded DryEyeShop.com. She's got a breakdown of all the ointments there. She's also founded the not-for-profit Dry Eye Foundation. Rebecca, thank you.
Thank you.
As the legal marijuana industry continues to penetrate in states across the country, an offshoot of that industry is budding. You might have heard of CBD. It's popping up everywhere, in beverages, cosmetics, even pet food. But what is it? Joining us now is Dr. Jeff Chen, director of the Cannabis Research Initiative at UCLA. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, so let's start with the basics here. For people who don't know at this point, what is CBD? What is it used for?
So CBD is cannabidiol, and not to be confused with cannabinoid. So a cannabinoid is a family of compounds that are unique to the cannabis plant. So THC, which is responsible for the psychoactivity of cannabis, that's a cannabinoid. CBD is also a cannabinoid.
But there's no THC in CBD.
Correct, but they both are part of the cannabinoid family, and they both tend to be the most abundant cannabinoids in the cannabis plant.
So what is CBD used for at this point?
So right now, there is only one FDA-approved indication for CBD. It was only FDA-approved about 6 months ago, and it is used to treat epilepsy, but a very specific kind of epilepsy, these rare forms of epilepsy that some children may suffer from. Many other governments around the world have approved CBD when used in combination with THC in a drug called Sativex for pain and muscle spasms in multiple sclerosis. And that's pretty much it throughout the rest of the world.
But if I go to the cafe downstairs from our office, they sell tea infused with CBD. So how is that possible?
So they aren't acquiring the CBD from marijuana, because that would be federally illegal. They are extracting CBD from hemp. So hemp, marijuana, cannabis, they're all referring to the same species of plant. We come up with these arbitrary terms depending on the level of THC in there. So when something is abundant in THC, we colloquially think of it as marijuana. When something has less than 0.3% THC, which is a very low amount, that is when our federal government defines it as hemp. And recently, there has been new legislation that classifies hemp as an agricultural product. It is no longer a controlled substance. And so what this commercial industry has done is they extract CBD from hemp, and it is an agricultural product, not an illegal narcotic.
And what does it do to you? If you're not taking it for this kind of epilepsy, what would you feel if you have something with CBD in it?
First off, you're not going to feel any psychoactivity. And from some of the surveys I've seen, the top three indications that people are reporting using CBD for is pain, insomnia, and anxiety. Hmm. And unfortunately, for all three of those areas, there's very little good human studies that have actually explored the use of CBD for those three domains.
Are there any negatives from CBD use so far that we know of?
CBD actually has a pretty favorable safety profile. The biggest concern is that it might interact with other drugs that you're taking. CBD interacts with your liver enzymes in such a way that it might boost the levels of other drugs that you're taking. For instance, benzodiazepines, antidepressants, things like that. And then another area that we don't have enough data on is for women who are pregnant. And CBD hasn't necessarily been widely used for long enough that we can necessarily see an effect at a population epidemiologic level. So I would say those are the two areas where we should probably be very cautious.
Do you think that at this point CBD is underregulated, overregulated, or adequately regulated?
I think there's a lot of conflicts between state and federal agencies and even in between federal agencies, and it's created a quagmire around CBD regulation. So I'll give you an example. As of a few weeks ago, the 2018 Farm Bill passed, and it explicitly removed hemp and any derivatives from hemp, such as CBD, from the Controlled Substances Act. Also, the same day that the federal Farm Bill was signed into law by President Trump, the FDA basically said, okay, hemp-derived CBD, it's no longer a narcotic, but we see it as a pharmaceutical drug because a pharmaceutical company has already pushed forward all this research and got this drug FDA approved. And therefore, you can only sell products with CBD in it if you come through the FDA and you get your stuff FDA approved. And so they are basically saying that all of this dietary supplement, herbal sales of CBD is illegal in the eyes of the FDA.
Do you take CBD?
I don't, actually.
Have you ever tried it?
I have.
Mm-hmm. And did it do much for you, or did you think it worked?
You know, I was taking escalating doses of CBD to see if I could experience any side effects, mm-hmm. or if I noticed any psychoactivity, and I did not.
Hmm. Interesting. That is Dr. Jeff Chen, who is director of the Cannabis Research Initiative at UCLA. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, do you use CBD? Let us know why at hereandnow.org. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now.